Welcome to the Science of Psychotherapy podcast with your hosts, Richard Hill and Matthew Dalitz.
Hi, and welcome to another episode of the Science of Psychotherapy podcast. My name is Matthew Dalitz, Editor-in-Chief of the Science of Psychotherapy, and I'm here with my wonderfully brainy friend and Managing Editor, Richard Hill. Howdy, Richard.
Look, I'm just squeezing my brain into the room now. I know you said I'm brainy, but it's partly because we've been talking about our guest's paper. And yes. You have to be brainy to be able to really delve into the depths of the paper. And so I'm very excited to get to talk about him, of course, about the technical aspects, but also about some of the practical applications and aspects of this. So you better now tell us who it is we're going to talk to, mystery guest.
Yes, so we're going to talk to Dr. Robert Moss. Now, anyone that's followed us for a while will know that Dr. Moss has been on The Neuropsychotherapist with a number of different articles, and I'll put them up in the show notes so that you can refresh your memories. But today, we're going to talk about a paper that he's been writing and isn't out yet, but will be in a few months, and it's called Psychotherapy in Pain Management. Now, his brain theories will also in our magazine, and I'll point you to some of that as well. But let me just let you know a little bit about Bob. He's with the North Mississippi Medical Center in Tupelo, Mississippi. He served as the founding editor-in-chief of the Ames Neuroscience Journal. He's board certified in clinical psychology and neuropsychology, and he's had over 20 years in private practice and is a former associate professor. And he's a very smart bloke.
And he's more brain. Yeah, it's harder for him to get his brain into the room than me. But I'm really keen to talk to him because, I've been working with my wife with pain for quite a few years. And he's taking this forward. This wonderful man is going to be a great assistance to chronic pain sufferers over the next decade and more. So let's go off to Robert Moss.
Dr. Robert Moss, thank you for joining us here on the Science of Psychotherapy podcast. How are you?
I'm all right. Thank you for having me.
Hi. Very nice to meet you.
Good to meet you as well.
Bob, where are you coming from? Where are you living at the moment?
I'm living in Tupelo, Mississippi, USA. Okay.
So, Robert, how are things over there in the South? You've been cooped up inside like all the rest of us?
I sure have. As best I can.
Now, we've got you on the show because you've got an amazing paper that is coming out very soon, in a few months, and we'll let our listeners know when that paper does come out. Psychotherapy in Pain Management, New Viewpoints and Treatment Targets Based on a Brain Theory.
Correct.
Now, we've had you featured before in the magazine with some very interesting ideas about the hippocampus and cortical columns and how memory consolidation and recall happens. And again, we'll point our listeners to those papers. But you've been building on these ideas, and you've got a couple of models, and you've got some ideas for treatment. And I'd like to dive in. We don't have a lot of time, but
okay.
Pain management and chronic pain is such a huge problem.
Yes.
And so brilliant to read this paper and some of the ideas that you've been percolating here sort of quietly behind the scenes.
Yeah, I just want to add just before you start going, Bob, this is one of the most well-researched and deeply engaged papers on pain that I have ever seen, and I've read a lot.
Thank you.
So congratulations on what you've written, but also the idea. And we'll see. I'll do a bit of challenging and see what we can do. But for now, please just get us in. Give us a bit of insight into this development that you've made and this extensive research into the neurobiological frameworks.
Well, I mean, obviously, I've worked in chronic pain since the 1980s, and so therefore, I've had a lot of years in clinical practice. In addition to working with a brain model that started back in '84, actually. And it's just developed over time. And as anybody who's worked with chronic pain patients knows, they're some of the most difficult patients in the world to deal with because they have an ongoing problem that doesn't go away. And so you have the current problem in terms of the pain. And quite honestly, most of the patients I've seen also have a history in terms of past negative emotional memories, particularly tied to relationships that are there. And so they're dealing with the pain. They're dealing with loss issues that are there, basically tied to things such as inability to work, inability to continue in terms of to produce, inability to do recreational activities. In addition to the loss issues and the current pain, then you have negative emotional memories many times that are there as well. So it's a very complex situation.
Yes, and I think this is the thing that we'll probably deal with as we go through. But that pain is a complex experience. It's not just simply an external or a stimulation or an internal stimulation onto the nerves, which then goes up into the brain and we go ow. As you're saying, you're talking about cognitive, you're talking about various types of frameworks, and you've managed to be able to differentiate these elements really really well. And I'm kind of not quite sure where we start. Will we start sort of from the nociception, that nerve perception first, and move up, or would you like to go from the top down, or would you like to just from the middle out,
Okay. Well, actually, in terms of the input that you're going to have to the brain, there's three different avenues back into the brain. So what most people are familiar with is through the somatosensory system, basically the sense of touch, movement, and things like that. But you also have projections to the thalamus that project the area called the insula, as well as the cingulate cortex, as well as you have a direct connection to the parabrachial nucleus, which directly connects to the amygdala, which everybody's kind of familiar with, I'm sure. And so therefore you have three different inputs. Basically, one's causing the sensation, one's causing the actual pain itself, and the other leads into the emotional components many times.
Now, your framing of all of this work is within two models that you describe. Would you introduce us to those models?
Yeah, the dimensional systems model is based upon the fact as the cortical column, as the binary digit, that all processing occurs in the cortex. And so circuits of columns allows us, based on the theory, to do everything that we do, from reading to talking to whatever it may be. Basically, within that theory, then, it actually gives kind of a roadmap to the cortex to understand how processing occurs in the different areas. And so, therefore, when you start looking at it, then it gives a means by which you can start to understand both the right and the left sides of the brain. For example, the right side, based on the theory, is it's going to process much faster because there's fewer cortical columns in each circuit compared to the left, which is more complex and has many more columns in the circuit. So, therefore, it's prone to doing analytical things such as our talking right now, speech and language. But basically, the emotional language is going to be controlled by the right side. In terms of pressure process and the intonations in our voice, how loud I speak, how fast I speak, facial expressions. And so the right side processes the emotional things, the left side's processing the verbal things most of the time. And so the actual dimensional systems model then leads into the clinical biopsychological model, where we're applying all this to actually understanding what's happening in the brain as we're trying to do treatment and we're analyzing what's going on with cases.
Right.
Yeah. So this then gives you a shifting approach to treatment, and I just want to highlight that aspect. You're saying the right and left brain. This idea of this right side. I suppose we could simplify it by saying it's conceptual. It goes on overall principles, and the left brain is so much more on details. And we can, as you say in your description of, there's a structural reflection of that through the column work that develops. Yeah.
And actually, when we talk to people in therapy, we're talking to the left side of the brain, but the way we access the right side are through experiential techniques or imagery, metaphor, those kinds of things. That's how we engage the right side. And that's the reason in the paper, as you were describing, it talks about the use of emotional restructuring, which I've talked about with Matt before, done a little paper for you guys. And basically, we can start talking about then what areas of the brain are being affected as we're dealing with that, both left and right, leading hopefully to resolution of a lot of the most important negative emotional memories that continue to influence people.
Right. Now, from a clinical perspective, you've been sort of trialing all of this sort of out at the clinic. What sort of results are you seeing?
Well, this is something I've been doing, as I say, since the 80s. The process is in terms of using the things for negative emotional memories. That's been since the early 90s working with that. And so I've had very good success. However, I was always working in private practice or working in a clinic setting. And so therefore, I really haven't had a chance to do any randomized clinical treatment. That's one of my hopes in terms of the paper, is to actually start to get some interest from people, actually have the ability to actually do that kind of thing.
Yeah.
Again, it's kind of like with anything else that we're talking about in terms of the treatment. We're dealing with current factors, with pain patients, your mindfulness relaxation techniques that people are most familiar with and so forth. However, one of the key things also with the paper is it talks about understanding why people do what they do, interpersonal behaviors and such. And therefore, we talk about the fact of just like we have that spoken language on the left side of the brain, we have a note of emotional language in our relationships by the right side that determines what feels positive and negative and how I react to that. But in the current paper, I've really tied in the cerebellum to really start to understand how that fits in with all that as well in terms of these automatic behaviors that start to occur.
It's interesting. We've had the good fortune to have some conversations with Joe Ledoux and Richard Brown, and they're talking of in this what they call higher order representations, but these cognitive representations that occur as one of the layers of the experience, and that memory, so that both your semantic but also your autobiographical memory is incredibly important, exactly as you've been saying. But it's also this that if you can shift these upper level cognitive processes, that can have some effect. And this is where I'm imagining the visualizations, the imagery, the metaphor, the relaxation. Is this where you're mostly having the effect in that cognitive thing, or how does it top down from there?
Well, actually, it's addressing both the left and the right sides as we're going through in terms of new schemas that are being presented to the left side of the brain. But the experiential kinds of things that I do in terms of role reversal, role plays, in addition to some of the imagery things to allow people to actually, if you will, basically to feel like they can win in terms of these relationship situations and so forth. So there's an anger expression component, but then as we kind of go through that, and that's in the paper as well, it leads into then more of a self-nurturing aspect that we really push for. And so there's a kind of sense of sadness for self, but then eventually it turns into a sadness for the other person actually who victimized you. I understand they cannot are incapable of doing different than what they did.
Right. The question I want to get around to is, how are you hoping this sort of research is going to change our approach to pain management? And at the beginning of your paper, you know, you describe the stark difference between sort of the approach that you're talking about and just straight up drug therapy.
So, well, and actually the drug therapy has seen us days now with all the stuff that's going on right now in terms of the opioid crisis and such. I'm sure that's everywhere. But it came right down to it now is that most of the things that have been done, Robert Gottschall and so forth, has written in such as regular pain management using cognitive behavioral approaches, relaxation. One of the things is that they understand that these pre-existing negative emotional memories tied to relationships, you can call them trauma or non-trauma memories, both. Mm-hmm. They understand that many times predisposes people to, when it's there, to actually experience chronic pain.
Right.
And so therefore, they've talked about it being a risk factor. What I'm proposing now is kind of like as opposed to looking at it as a risk factor that you can't change, you look at it as an ever-present factor that is changeable. That if you address it, then you can actually take that component and actually see some pretty big improvement for people.
Right.
Yes, it's interesting. On a sort of simplistic level, there's a number of people, because I keep an eye on these chronic pain and pain processes, and there are lots of people saying, you know, clear that pain, end that pain, get rid of your pain. They've got a lovely terms for it. And fundamentally what they do is what I would just call a guided meditation, a guided imagery. And one of the things that is sometimes found, a lot of these people don't seem to know what they're doing, but is sometimes found is that the pain experience can virtually disappear. Can, you know, essentially disappear. So this idea that sometimes the pain, the stimulation that has caused the chronic pain in the early days, that stimulation may have, that physical stimulation may have resolved itself, and it's an entirely higher level set of processes. Is that anything that you've found in your work, or anything near that?
Well, again, you see changes in terms of as things register, and that's in the paper as well, talking about the fact of initially you see certain activation in terms of what's called the pain matrix and so forth. With acute pain, it's the same kind of thing you see, whether it's people that have chronic pain that you give an acute stimulus to, or just people that are non-pain patients. But your people who become chronic pain patients over the process of the year, 2 years, they're showing that it actually caused a major change in terms of the areas being involved, such as the medial frontal area, as well as the amygdala, as well as nucleus accumbens. Kind of that region is where you actually see most of the activity, as opposed to the somatosensory areas, insula, those kinds of things. So it actually changes in terms of what you're seeing. And that's part of what I try to explain in the paper, is how those kinds of things can actually occur.
Yeah, because that's interesting, that change in gray matter in the dorsolateral prefrontal cortex, if my memory of the paper is correct, that area I sort of twig as being, you know, sort of interruption area or decision-making. What's the nature of the way that prefrontal cortex, that change in gray matter, what is that telling you about?
Well, actually, that's even in the paper. A lot of it has to do with what's being used at the time, okay? And that's the reason that you can see over time, basically, you can see gray matter increases, decreases, and so forth, dependent upon what's actually being used within the brain or which areas. And so therefore, to some extent, you're seeing that, and that's the reason that I kind of got into it in detail in the paper, that you actually can see one front side of the brain inhibiting the other and so forth. And that decrease in activity and so forth could actually lead to basically some of the loss of the gray matter. There was even one study that looked at people that have hip arthritis. It's a curable kind of pain. And they actually showed that in these kinds of people that you can see some of this gray matter decrease, but if they actually have the operation, they're pain-free, then that actually reverses right away or very shortly thereafter. And so therefore, it's kind of like it has to do with the fact of if I'm focused on the pain all the time, I'm not going to be outwardly focused and actually using the lateral cortex as much. So there's all kinds of things that kind of enter in terms of the nuances that can cause that.
Right. As we've been talking to people about, you know, representations of representations, this also has a lot to do with the interpretation of signals, right?
But also, let's go beyond just the lateral cortex. That's what you're talking about here. That codes for things outside of us. Yeah. More important, the kind of what we're talking about is the medial areas that basically are self-referential, things that are internal and so forth. Yeah. And that's where your things like your urges to have take medication, these kinds of things, whatever it may be, the kind of things that more or less motivate us to do, that's the reason that when we're in pain so much of the time, then many times they're going to be much more inwardly focused. Mm-hmm. And so therefore, you're going to see a lot more activity there. But when it comes down to it, is part of what I'm proposing in the paper as well, for the people that have had these negative emotional memories that continue to affect them, it's that medial cortex where basically we're starting to see the most important parts, because that's where I feel like I can't control anything, I feel like I can't measure up. Those kinds of things come from medial cortex as opposed to lateral cortex.
Yeah, right.
And so outside versus inside, and the transitional between those two.
Yeah.
So anyway, we don't want to get too technical, but...
No, it's really good. I think we're just piecing it together, because there are a couple of things I want you to expand on, but one of the things that is really useful, I think, in the paper, and this is why the detail of it is so delightful. Some people might take a bit of time and have a few readings to grab it, but that the nature of nerve response in the body to painful processes is not, you just don't have a pain, an action and then a bunch of nerve responses, but there's actually about three systems. We've got and you put it, well, the correct ones, the A delta, the alpha beta, and the C fibers. Just a quick, if we could just explain a little bit these sort of fast and slow and how these, the ways in which your body responds to the thing that is stimulating it, the painful stimulus, also affects the nature of the way the pain arrives into the brain. If I'm badly sort of using bad terminology.
Yeah, well, again, when you start looking at it, you have fast-conducting fibers, the A-delta fibers that carry the pain signal. That's the first pain they usually talk about. And then the second pain of the more, if you will, the gut-retching kind of stuff that comes along, that's the C-fibers that are not myelinated. They're much slower in terms of speed. But those are the ones that go to the middle portion of the thalamus to get projected to the insula, which basically is, if you will, one of the best ways to look at the insula is looking at, it kind of gives me an interoceptive kind of gauge that's there to let me kind of monitor what's going on internally, whether positive emotions, whether negative emotions and things. And then you have the cingulate cortex that receives it. And that, as I put in the paper, basically is involved with kind of making the decisions as to intentional volition, basically what is going to happen, what's going to be the action that pursues and so forth. And that is actually separate from the parabrachial nucleus that goes directly to the amygdala. And so therefore you can actually have going to the central amygdala an immediate response to the pain that leads to some of the emotional kinds of reactions that are there. All of these kinds of things. But the C fibers go to the parabrachial amygdala and the C fibers go to the insula and to the cingulate cortex is where they go. And A delta go to S1, which is what people kind of think about, is basically where I have that feeling, the sensation, touch in the parietal lobe.
If I can, I'm not sure whether this is a good example, but I think, because I know the C fibers, they're particularly related to temperature disturbance, to the perceptions. Right. So that thing, you put your finger on something hot, there's these A fibers that give a automatic reaction. You quickly. Correct. And then there's that little slow reaction, oh, gee, that's hot.
That's when you get the burning sensation, the pain. Correct.
Yeah. So just for the listeners, that's gives you a practical sort of day-to-day experience of these different speeds that go on. It's so interesting to understand that.
Yeah. Yeah. Are you able to give us just a very brief sort of case study, a made-up case study?
Well, actually, I went for the book that I'm going to use, that I've been seeing and things. It was actually a work injury that this guy sustained and so forth. Shoulder injury. He was diagnosed as complex regional pain syndrome, even though that questionable diagnosis at this point. But when I first started seeing him, he really did not believe there's any need for a psychologist to be involved. You know, he's got the physical pain and things like that. But basically, he had a history, if I can remember all this stuff off the top of my head, had lost a wife 10 years ago, so he had unresolved grief. Actually, he had not coped with that whatsoever. He had a history in terms of really, I think it was his mother that was so real negative and so forth that created a lot of negative emotional stuff for him. And so therefore, it's kind of like as we started going through, I normally will deal first with those past negative emotional memories that are there, okay? Typically, using emotional restructuring, like for a parent issue, we're talking about 1 to 2 sessions before we're finished, usually 1 session, sometimes 2. The unresolved grief was one that he really benefited from, which is a single session that we're going through. And it's basically just having him go back through the actual loss itself 2 or 3 times, detailing. Anxiety goes high at that point, but at the end, being able to basically go to the point of saying goodbye. And you can tell unresolved grief all the time, because that person just cannot say goodbye. They can't understand why they can't get that word out. Mm-hmm. And for him, he actually didn't do it in session. He agreed to do it and after the session, and actually he did it, went to the grave, which he had not been to in almost 10 years, and actually got through the process. And it was like everything between the combination of all that, it was just like a lifting, both the unresolved grief as well as dealing with the past negative emotional stuff tied to parent. And so basically he was already the kind of person, he was very motivated to do things to be able to achieve. And so it's just basically taking some roadblocks out of his way. And so for him, he's just done phenomenally well in terms of it. Yeah. I guess a total of 10 sessions is what we did.
Yeah, I just want to interrupt quickly those people out there who are going, so we're saying everything's in our head. We're making it up. And it's not the case at all. And just be careful of thinking that. But pain, all our perceptions, and this is what Joe Ledoux and Richard Brown are saying, fear as well, they're all related to a complex set of processes of which your mentalizing, your conscious mentalizing is one of them, and it's a terribly important one. And how fascinating that with this case, you're actually able to radically reduce the pain.
You're able to reduce the emotional stuff, but the pain is still there.
That's right. There's still...
Yeah, so the pain doesn't go away. There are people who are resilient to pain or like a trauma or whatever, and there are people who are not resilient to it. And so many people that I've seen, when they have past negative emotional stuff that's there, the way they've learned to cope in their life is to be busy and active. They have the chronic pain and their coping strategy is now shot because they can no longer be busy and active and avoid thinking they feel out of control. And these memories that continue to have an influence on the person later on have that out of control, uncontrollability aspect to it. And so it reactivates the negative emotional memories in addition to dealing with the current problem of feeling out of control. So it's a set of circumstances that occurs.
Yeah. So to get these emotional things out of the way so that you still may perceive pain, but it doesn't overwhelm you, it doesn't stop you in your tracks, it doesn't depress you.
Part of it is a constructivist approach as well. At the end, it's kind of like one of the keys is basically feeling like they're going towards something as opposed to just losing everything. And so therefore, it's kind of like if they can reset and actually determine new goals in life in the process of all this. And that's particularly healthy for people that have a strong spiritual bent, if you will. Mm-hmm. They can start to understand that this is some place that I can actually grow. But the bottom line comes down to it is that most of the people, when I start seeing them, they feel like they're losing everything. They can't do what they used to do, and they don't feel like they're going anywhere.
Yes, I'm sort of a less expert than you, but I did have a client who had a spinal injury. So there was a chronic pain, and he said, "I'm accept the fact that I'm going to have a 2 or 3 on the Likert scale for most of my life." I said, "But I just feel that when I'm in certain emotional states, when I have certain states of anxiety, as you were saying, and various other things, that I shoot it up to a 7 or an 8." And he came to me to learn how to just get rid of that part. Mm-hmm. And it was fascinating. In the process, he actually developed his own somatic sort of behavior pattern. And he just created a situation where he put his hands, and it's a long story, but he put his hands to the side of his head, took a hold of the pain and moved it out of his head, his perception of the pain, moved it out of his head. And he said, "Oh, great, that works." And I said, "How are you feeling now?" He said, "I'm back to a 2 or 3. So exactly this playing out as your paper so beautifully describes all the mechanisms that for him there was a baseline that was manageable, but it was his mentalization that was making it so difficult. Mm. So,
yeah, this reminds me of our conversation, Richard, we've had recently about anxiety. It's very much the same sort of processes, isn't it, with the focus on the anxiety and the symptoms and that can send you into a downward spiral or you refocus.
You're exactly right. But again, so much of it is when they have the chronic pain, they're going to have the anxiety and the depression both as well.
Yeah.
So they're predisposed to a lot of that kind of thing already in many cases.
Yes. And this medication idea of deadening the pain response is probably deadening a lot of other elements.
Right. The whole concept, I was back when they first started doing it. When I first went into pain, they would not do any kind of long-term opiate medications. It was back in the 90s that actually changed. Right. American Pain Society really pushed it and so forth. And that's when they started doing the prescriptions for long-term use of opiates. But then they had no regulation in terms of who was doing what. And basically all the physicians got involved in prescribing just like primary care. And they would just dole it out to people without any kind of real awareness in terms of exactly what they're doing. Yeah. So it's not being done wisely. And so now we're seeing the repercussions. It's gone the full swing back the other direction now to a large extent.
And it's interesting also now we've got this other shift to explore the cannabinoids. So the oils there, which have some beneficials, but still it's this grasping of the biological responses, it's the neurobiological responses, and the emotional states that emerge out of that.
Right. Of course, our pain program, and basically the people are still getting opiates and so forth. Again, that's well controlled. They actually have to go through urine drug screens each time they come in. So therefore, there's a lot of constraints in terms of what they do. But the bottom line comes down to it is that, no, those medications are still there. They didn't take them away. They're just basically being administered now within the context of a pain program where they've got constraints and controls. And nobody with a benzodiazepine can have opiate medications now in this state.
You can't
prescribe both. You've got a choice, one or the other.
Well, I really hope that you get an opportunity then to do some clinical trials and get some stats behind what you've been writing about. You've certainly been a trailblazer in terms of the theoretical aspect of this.
Oh, thank you.
Yes, yes. No, it's very exciting. And thank you so much for sharing a case study. We know that becomes part of the anecdotal framework for research later. But it just helps us get a grasp. I had my little one, which was hopefully helpful as well. But how much of your work is research and how much of your work is actually working with clients to achieve?
Well, right now, I'm in a purely clinical setting right now.
Right,
I have been for most of my career, actually. I did a lot of research back in the 80s and so forth when I was in a university setting. I had a federal grant through doing facial pain, headache research and stuff back then. But most of the time it's been in clinical practice since then. And that's one of the reasons, it's kind of like as I continue to do it, I develop things in clinical practice in addition to the theoretical model to support it. But as we've talked about, the missing component right now is having somebody take the treatment manual that's actually there and actually do it with some randomized controlled studies.
Right.
Yeah. Yeah.
So great positive indications for future development of our understanding, and it dovetails.
We'll get somebody else to take over, because I'm getting to be old, and it's kind of like I'd love to have somebody take over and be responsible for it now.
Oh, no, right. Just figure it out. I want it figured out by Wednesday.
There you go.
Robert, is there anything that you'd like to leave our listeners with before we wrap up?
Just basically, it's kind of like I just hope people keep an open mind as they're starting to look at it, because right now when people talk about the brain when it comes to chronic pain, they talk about it as if they're talking about different areas, modules, those kinds of things, and it's all going to go back to circuitry. And so therefore, hopefully this will take it a step forward to start to say, okay, let's look at the circuits very carefully. And there's more and more that's coming out right now to support the fact that the colorectal column is the binary digit. There's actually a study that came out last year in Proceedings of the National Academy of Sciences, where basically they actually did a demonstration that basically, call it neural correlates of consciousness, that basically that when people are imagining one direction versus another, they can actually see different columns that are involved with each. So therefore, it's warranted now to say it's got considered a neural correlate of consciousness, which is the very key that was needed to be there.
And Matt, as we so often hear with our people coming in like you, Bob, just saying, wow, it's just starting. There's so much more to know. There's so much more to understand.
And that's that paper that I mentioned there cited in the first part of the paper that you guys have. So you have all that information.
Yeah.
Great.
Fantastic. Well, Dr. Robert Moss, thank you so much for joining us here on the Science of Psychotherapy podcast.
Well, I do appreciate your having me.
Yeah, it's wonderful to have you, Bob. And I just feel so privileged to have been able to read this paper early in the piece. I look forward to everybody able to do the same.
Fantastic.
Okay, so for now, bye-bye to Tupelo.
There you go. I hope Australia's going well. You have a nice day. I'm about to go to bed myself.
Fantastic.
Okay, right. Bye-bye.
Take care.
Okay, my brain is did its best to keep up with Bob there, but I think we delved enough into the realities of it and the practicalities of it, and enough into the technicalities to show people that there's a lot going on. So I hope everybody's had a bit of a balance of both.
Yes, well, his paper is very deep and technical, and I was wondering how we're going to scratch the surface. I think we scratched a little part of the surface, but enough to sort of, you know, give people an idea of where Bob is going with this research. I'm really looking forward to clinical trials coming up hopefully soon with this, but we will let everybody know when the paper comes out. It is something that I think is going to be very significant for the pain management space.
Yeah, and this idea that we continue to make improvements in our capacities to assist people who are suffering from chronic pain, which is a bit of a disaster of the modern age, but certainly it's become one in this rather single-focused sort of codeine type of therapy. So fantastic. Everybody have a listen and keep an eye out, and we'll keep being enthusiastic about the work that Bob does.
Wonderful. Now, if you appreciate what we're doing here at the Science of Psychotherapy and our podcast, we'd love you to support us by becoming a subscriber at thescienceofpsychotherapy.net. If you'd like to jump across, and we've got stacks of material for you there, and at a very low cost, and we would really appreciate the support. So I'd love you to be part of the tribe.
Yep, support and grow. It's a fantastic win-win situation. Love it. Okay.
Richard, it's been wonderful. Thanks, everybody, for joining us here at the Science of Psychotherapy podcast. We'll catch you next week.
Bye for now.
Thanks for listening to the Science of Psychotherapy podcast. For more great science, go to thescienceofpsychotherapy.com.